This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Many colleges and universities would agree that the purposes of a higher education include teaching the virtues of respectful debate, to form citizens, to teach young people to speak in their own voices and respect the voices of others, to shape students' characters and look beyond the classroom to the community, the workplace, and to a world where moral decisions must be made. To which Stanley Fish replies, "No, no, 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 and no." He adds that Holocaust denial, free speech, the war in Iraq, and other hot-button issues of the day are not appropriate subjects for classroom debate, and that it's not a university's job to be an engine of social progress. It is, he concedes, a minority view. So what is the purpose of a liberal arts education? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, we'll answer the musical question, can you teach kids good taste? But first, Stanley Fish joins us. He's currently distinguished university professor and a professor of law at Florida International University and dean emeritus at the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois, Chicago. His new book is called Save the World on Your Own Time. He joins us today from a studio in Woodstock, New York, and thanks very much for coming in.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
So why isn't shaping a student's character an appropriate, even laudable aim of a liberal arts education?
Well, it goes back to the idea, or at least my idea, that teaching is a job, not a holy mission. And like any other job, it involves certain skills that you have presumably acquired through training. And those are the skills that you should exercise, and that you should not take it upon yourself to exercise the skills that belong to other profession and other professionals who have been trained in them. So I ask the very simple question, what is it that we as college and university professors have been trained to do? And I come up with a simple answer. We can do two things legitimately. Introduce students to materials or traditions of inquiry with which they were previously unfamiliar, and equip those students with the analytical skills that allow them to move intelligently within those traditions. And my point is, that's it. Anything less, of course, is a dereliction of duty. Anything more means you've taken on a job for which you were not trained.
So a student's character might be a job for their parents or their pastors or their ministers, but not the job for their college professor.
Yes, and I don't know exactly how character should be trained and by whom. I just know that that's not our job.
And as you look at these other goals that so many colleges and universities have established for themselves, you look at their mission statements a lot in your book, you come up with a lot of things that they're doing that you say they shouldn't be doing at all.
That's true. The list that you gave in the introduction of topics like Holocaust denial or intelligent design, these are topics that certainly can be discussed in an academic classroom as I envision it. That is, you can look at the debate surrounding these topics. What I'm saying is that you shouldn't, as a teacher, try to move your students in one ideological direction or another, so that there's a difference between taking a highly politically charged topic and making the classroom a theater for a political witnessing, and on the other hand, taking a highly charged political topic into the classroom and making it the subject of an academic interrogation. And the second is the only thing I think that should be going on in the classroom.
So for intelligence design, for example, you could examine the theories of Darwin and the theories of the proponents of intelligence design. You could talk about the phenomenon of why people believe one or the other, but you're not talking about students' opinions or a teacher's opinions about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
That's right, and that's a line that some people find difficult to draw, but I don't think it's difficult to draw at all. It's the difference between considering a topic in order to study its history, its structure, its relationship to other topics. On the one hand, that's the academic enterprise, and on the other hand, considering a topic with a view toward, at the end of the discussion, going out and marching for a cause or giving money to a candidate or taking to the barriers.
You tell an anecdote in your book about you and your students in your writing class deconstructing a speech by John Kerry.
Yes. In my first-year composition class, we took two paragraphs from recent speeches. This was in 2004, given by President Bush and then Senator Kerry, and then we analyzed them, and then we assessed, that is, gave grades to the two candidates, and Kerry's grade was very much lower than Bush's. It was 14-2 in favor of Bush. I was one of the 14. But 6 weeks later, I went out and voted for Senator Kerry because my academic analysis of what I thought to be the weakness of his presentation had nothing to do with my analysis of his positions in relation to where I thought the country should be going. So it's, again, it's I hope, a neat example of how there's an academic way to examine something, but it can easily be and should be distinguished from political actions that you then take.
We're talking with Stanley Fish, an iconoclastic teacher himself. If you'd like to join the conversation about the purpose of higher education, give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Ralph is with us on the line from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Yes, hello. I am an adjunct professor at Liberal Studies College here in the area. And I'll make my point real quick. What I've learned over the few years teaching these classes in liberal studies education is that critical thinking and finding ways of finding your knowledge of self and managing emotions are all interconnected aspects of truly living your full potential. So many of those students don't go on into the academics. They will not go on to master degrees or PhDs or even elaborate research on topics that concern everyday life decisions. And I think that the academic analysis sort of assumes that we assume a mechanistic sort of worldview where we recite information in a style of No Child Left Behind. And we sort of leave out these things and the responsibility that we have to teach them to not get defensive, not deny, and sort of be open for new ideas and grow and learn.
Well, may I answer that?
You may.
Okay. First of all, I never talked about merely retailing or reciting information. Academic topics are, by themselves, extraordinarily complex. If you decide to study the ways in which the figure of the hero has been presented in literature and philosophy throughout the centuries, you're going to find yourself engaging in a very complicated and rigorous exercise, and one that can evoke or produce great passions on the part of the students. That has nothing to do with learning how to live your own potential. I don't even know what a phrase like living up to your own potential means. I certainly know that in my own training in graduate school, no one taught me how to bring students to that kind of realization. I was taught how to bring students to an understanding of certain bodies of material, either in my case, literary materials or legal materials. And that's a big enough job for anyone without taking on all of those other grand-sounding jobs, which usually degenerate into bull session talks.
Ralph?
Yes. Well, I disagree. It goes against what I see in the classroom. I understand what you're saying, and I do research myself, having a PhD application at the University of Chicago, and I understand. But I think I think that you cannot separate the two. I think it's impossible. I think it's impossible to separate the academic experience and learning from these sort of things that I pointed towards. I think that's what liberal education is, that bridge to that.
I don't think of liberal education as a bridge to anything. Like any other enterprise that's worth its salt, it has its own values. And the values are the values generally of academic in interrogation. As for separating the two, I would say that's extremely easy. And at least I begin in my classes by saying to my students, I am not in the slightest interested in any opinion that you have ever had about anything. Nor should you be interested in my opinions, except the opinions that come along with my expertise as a credentialed scholar. We're not here to give opinions. We're here to analyze phenomenon, be they poems or chemical reactions or a historical event. Once students learn that the giving of their own opinions or the expression of their precious little selves is not what is going on here, separation that you say is impossible becomes quite easy and actually energetic and enthusiastic.
When you analyze any phenomena, it starts with an opinion. You read a paper on something new, a new phenomena, a criticism or something like that. If you don't have a point of view or a perspective...
You're not listening. I didn't say no point of view. I'm saying academic point of view as opposed to a political point of view.
Not yet either. I'm not saying perception itself. I'm saying that if you don't have an opinion about what you read, then how can you put yourself in context with
it? I didn't say don't have opinions about what you read in an academic sense. When I teach, let's say, a play, Hamlet, or a poem like Paradise Lost, which is full of controversial questions, I have very firm answers to those questions. They themselves are academic questions. My answers are academic. That is, they belong to the tradition of inquiry that we're studying in the class. This is a long way from giving your opinion on some hot-button issue like the list of issues that was named at the top of the program.
Ralph, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We'll have more of your calls in a moment and talk more with Stanley Fish about his new book, Save the World, On Your Own Time. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll also find out what Stanley Fish thinks about some of the ways that colleges raise money today. Should a school take money from tobacco companies, for example, or invest in a company that does business with Sudan? We'll ask him and take more of your calls again. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Stanley Fish is our guest today. His new book is titled Save the World on Your Own Time. While he has plenty of advice in the book for college and university professors, he also writes that the wrong messages can be sent by institutions as well as those they employ. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. So what is the purpose of liberal arts education? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Stanley Fish, let me ask you, you posit that a lot of professors and students and indeed some institutions would argue that accepting money from a tobacco company or a company that does business with Sudan, well, it's dirty money. It should not be accepted.
Well, I certainly think it should not be accepted if it's money illegally gained or there is some reason to believe that a criminal enterprise is involved. But in fact, if it's money from a country or a corporation whose values the university would not endorse, there's no reason to reject the money because the university, at least in my view, is not in the business of endorsing values except for academic values. And if you start, for example, with, let's say, disinvesting from South Africa or Israel because you disapprove of those countries' policies at various points in history, then you're going to be going down the road toward what a major British Association of Academics did in 2006, which is vote that none of the journals that were none of the academic journals or institutions in Britain should have anything to do with Israeli academics unless those Israeli academics first disavow the policies of their governments. That's where universities taking a stand on the vexed moral and political issues of the day finally leads to a kind of involvement which takes the university's eye off its main mission, which is to impart knowledge and to equip students with analytical skills, and makes them into political agents.
Here's an email we have from Mike in San Jose, California. I'm a college student here in San Jose majoring in computer science. Amazingly, even this program has not kept me safe from the building a better person education the colleges want to give. I've been required to do community service, or as they call it, service learning, a few times. While community service is indeed something more people should take part in, never once has any of these service learning experiences helped me to gain a better understanding of microprocessors. To top it off, when I bring this up to the school's administration, they tell me it's a school requirement and I have to deal with it.
Well, I thoroughly sympathize with the person who sent in that email. There's nothing wrong with service learning or community service, so long as they are thought of as extracurricular activities, which means they should neither be required nor should you get academic credit for them. Again, that is part of the effort spearheaded by former President Bach and others to make the universities into engines of character transformation or of moral growth. And I've never seen any good argument that explains why it is that we, as instructors with PhDs in English or chemistry or the social sciences, are equipped to do that.
Let's get Camille on the line. Camille calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, I have a PhD in philosophy, and I've been teaching for 20 years, and I could not agree with Professor Fish more. I found that most students come to us with their characters already very well formed, for better or worse, and that, as one of the schools I taught at said, it is our job to shape students' souls. I find that we're not equipped to do that, that's incredibly arrogant to assume that we are. And as someone who's from a low-income, working-class background, I know that I learned my values and ethics from my family and the people with whom I grew up, not in academia. So I'm curious as to why it is that we're in the minority. I'm interested in seeing whether Professor Fish has anything to say about that, as to why we are in the minority on that.
Well, that may be the result of a historical accident. Many of the 60s radicals who did not see their political hopes realized in the public sphere turned to education and thought that perhaps that sphere, the arena of higher education especially, could become transformative in the direction that they favored. So they come into the classroom with the idea that it is their job to attempt to further the goals that they began to believe in and work for in the 1960s. That generation, which more or less fills most of the tenured positions in liberal arts departments, especially humanities and social sciences, is now in the act of retiring. And I don't believe that the next generation of teachers will, in fact, have the same missionary zeal. So it may be that the caller and I will not be in the minority in a few years, I only hope that I live to see it.
Don't you fear, though, this pendulum might swing the other way and people with a different political agenda will see, hey, it's our turn?
Yeah, well, that's the problem, exactly the problem. The right wants classrooms to mirror, reflect, and preach traditional values. The left wants classrooms to subvert traditional values. I want classrooms to stand up for only academic values for the analysis and interrogation of materials, so that if my view were ever to take hold, all of these political battles over the classroom would end, because politics would be a subject in the classroom rather than an activity being performed in the classroom.
I appreciate that. I think he's absolutely right. These culture wars that I've seen going on in this jockeying for position, you know, between the right and the left, I think they feed off of one another, and it's unfortunate. I thank you very much for your book. I look forward to reading it.
Camille, thanks very much for the phone call. Here's another email. This is from Rob in East in St. Louis, Missouri. In most postgraduate professional schools, faculty are responsible to teach professionalism or even a code of ethics of their professions to students. That task necessarily involves ethical training and direction about how students must live their professional lives. Does Professor Fish object to that kind of ethical training?
Well, there are two questions here. One is, are professional schools part of the liberal arts educational world? And I would say that in some cases they are not. I'm a member of a law school faculty, and law school faculties are always debating the relationship between what they do and what is done in other departments in the university. Are we a trade school? Are we preparing people to do a certain job? Or are we introducing people to complex questions through the study of very rich and complicated texts? If, in fact, you're a trade school, basically, then you're not in the education business, even though you're housed in a university setting. And of course, professional codes of ethics, when they are taught, in a professional school are very narrowly conceived. They're the answers to questions like, when your client tells you that he is about to commit a crime, what are your duties? These are duties which are spelled out in law, which have penalties, and that's quite different from forming a lawyer who is able to be responsible to the ethical and legal demands of his profession is, I think, quite different from forming someone who is, in fact, in the largest sense, ethical.
The ethics you do talk about that are appropriate, though, are ethics of the academy in terms of its integrity.
Yes. And I talk about that to stave off or to ward off an accusation, which is that I'm arguing for a value-free classroom and a value-free university. No, I'm arguing for a university that it's true to academic values rather than to the values which might in fact be wonderful values but belong properly to another enterprise. So on the academic side, the values of instructors are, of course, the pedagogical ones of being prepared for class, keeping up with one's discipline, assigning and correcting papers, coming to class regularly, holding office hours, etc. And those values then spill over into the professor's research, where it's an obligation of someone who is doing research to take account of all of the evidence, to note dissent from his or her opinion, and, of course, to acknowledge any sources so that you don't present your own work when it's something that's someone else's work as your own. Those are all very strong values, and the university should be alert to their infringement. And so, again, I don't want to talk about a value-free university. I want to talk about a university that is, by definition, committed to academic values.
Let's get Patrick on the line. Patrick with us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Hi. I really appreciate your guest today. His comments are very germane to what I do. I'm a high school social sciences teacher, and I also happen to be a graduate student getting my master's in European history, and I teach a course in, it's like an introduction to law course. I also teach a course on the Vietnam War and one on the Holocaust, and I'd like your guest to address the issue of a very fine line between teaching about religion versus teaching religion, because I, just today, as a matter of fact, was teaching my students in my Holocaust course about the sources, the literary, historical, mythological roots to Judaism in order to introduce them to modern Jewish people and how they were affected by the Nazi regime in Germany. And I find I have to be very, very careful not to cross a certain almost very gray and invisible line between preaching and teaching. And I'd like your guest to address that.
Well, I agree that that is the line that should not be crossed. I'm not sure that it is all that gray. You ask yourself a question, in this discussion, in this class, am I asking my students to analyze positions, to look at the historical antecedents of present debates, etc., or am I in some way moving them toward an ideological or political view on the position? Now, in my case, since I teach Christian literature of the 16th and 17th century, it's easy for me to separate my teaching from my personal views, if only because I am myself not a Christian. But I do teach Christianity all the time, and I teach Christianity because I believe that the understanding of the of Christian doctrines is absolutely crucial if you are going to be able to read intelligently poets like John Milton or John Donne or George Herbert or Spencer or Shakespeare. And that, I think, is the distinction. Religion, of course, should be introduced as a topic of study. It's enormously influential, a huge history, a history that intertwines with almost anything else you would want to study. But you can certainly teach these doctrines without, in fact, either approving or disapproving them.
Well, I've just breathed a mental sigh of relief because that's precisely the tack I've taken, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think you can't study some of these things without knowing about the people that were involved in these historical events, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Patrick. Again, we're talking with Stanley Fish about his new book, Save the World on Your Own Time, from the Oxford University Press, 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, email us talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Professor Fish, when you're talking about professors shouldn't express their own opinions about issues of the day and that sort of thing, aren't you infringing academic freedom?
Well, first of all, that's a good question, because academic freedom is often invoked in discussions like this one. But academic freedom is really a very thin, almost non-existent concept. Legally, it has no status at all. That is, it's sometimes mentioned in Supreme Court cases, but in almost all Supreme Court cases and lower court cases, courts defer to universities when making judgments about their own actions. In my view, academic freedom receives a very limited definition. It's the freedom to do your own job, as defined by your contract and your training. It is therefore not the freedom to do someone else's job or the freedom to shirk your own job. Many academics unfurl the academic freedom banner when they want either to step outside of their sphere of competence or when they want to be irresponsible in exercising the responsibilities of teaching. So that I think that academic freedom more often than not is an excuse for slipshod behavior and doesn't actually have a very robust existence. Again, it's the freedom to do the academic job, which in my view, as I've already said several times, is the job of introducing students to materials and equipping them with the skills that will allow them to move easily within those materials. You should be free to do that. Any other freedom that you're claiming is, I think, license.
Let's get Ruth on the line. Ruth with us from Syracuse in New York.
Hi. I'm a recent college graduate, and I just wanted to say that I didn't find any of what you're talking about in my education. I didn't have professors coming up to me and saying, well, this is what you should believe. They would present an issue, and then we would discuss that issue. And so we learned, we'd be presented a bunch of papers and with both sides, and at the end of the argument, we would have to come up with our own conclusion. And that was the critical thinking skills was what I felt like I got a lot out of college, and not the actual, this is what you should believe.
So you don't think you were indoctrinated?
Not at all.
Were you asked to come to your own conclusion? In the classroom?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. Perhaps the final paper would be a discussion of what you've learned throughout the semester.
Well, again, that would depend on whether what you learned throughout the semester was the way in which the particular topic or topics had been discussed, analyzed their history, or what you learned during the semester was how to think about a particular topic leading into a particular decision about that topic. I don't think that any class should end with students being asked to make a decision about an ethical or political issue. The focus should be on studying the ways in which those issues have been discussed. The assessment should be made of the logic or coherence of the arguments offered by various participants in the discussion.
And we just have a few seconds left, Ruth, but does that sound like what you were doing?
I suppose the difference is that I'm a science major, and so I come at it from a science perspective. And in that sense, you really do need to make decisions at the end, because you can't go out in the world and just have all these facts but no ideas about what they mean. And like for climate change,
I agree that the decision that you should be able to make or should make or at the end of a class should be an academic decision. That is, you can decide that the arguments in favor of a certain position, let's say the reading of a poem or the analysis of a historical event, are unpersuasive or are persuasive. But you're making a judgment on the coherence of the arguments. You are, in effect, still distancing yourself from the substantive views on the particular subject.
Ruth, thanks very much. Congratulations on your graduation.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. And Stanley Fisher, we appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Stanley Fish's new book, Save the World on Your Own Time, and he joined us today from a studio in Woodstock, New York. When we come back, we're going to be talking about how a music critic takes his son to classical concerts and wonders, can you teach good taste? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.